Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. And this is our 2020 post-election, we could all use a little historical perspective and some sleep special. All week we've been asking ourselves, and we've been asking you listeners, what historical moment are you thinking about in this moment in history? As the election count continues to determine who won the 2020 presidency, control of the Senate, asterisk, you kind of have to say that as you're recording these days. You kind of have to timestamp when you're recording this. So we are recording this actually on Friday morning, November 6th. A winner has not really been declared, but just before we started taping, the vote count showed that Joe Biden is ahead in Pennsylvania, and that is very likely going to mean that he is going to take the presidency, take Pennsylvania, and take the presidency. Something we can absolutely say is that more people voted in this election than any election in history. So, we're recording this at an interesting moment. I'm sort of hearkening back to my live news days here, but this is not a breaking news podcast. It is a history podcast. Nevertheless, that is the moment in which we are recording at a very interesting moment. And this episode is a little different for lots of reasons, but we're not going to just focus on one historical moment, but riff through a bunch of them. And I will just say that it's been really great to read your emails and thoughts and your tweets. And thank you, everyone, for sending them our way. We're going to get through as many as we can. Here to do that is, as always, Nicole Hemmer of Columbia. Hello, Nikki.
Hello, Jody. Happy Election Day Part 4?
3, 4, who knows at this point. we can talk about this a little bit, but this is exactly kind of how people said it was going to play out. Mm-hmm. And I know it still felt like a roller coaster, but yes, it is. The process is sort of working. But there are still some lessons from history about kind of how it works and how it doesn't work and so forth. And our special guest to sort of sift through that is Kelly Carter Jackson, coming back on the show, assistant professor at Wellesley. Welcome back, Kelly, and thanks for indulging us in this special show at this very interesting moment.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start with the three of us, and we'll kind of answer our very simple question here. What moment in history are you thinking about in this moment? So Kelly, you wanna start first?
Yeah, I'm thinking about the 19th century. That's sort of my bread and butter. But I think about the tumultuous 1850s and how if you were an enslaved person or you were an abolitionist during the 1850s, it would seem completely dismal. There were no new pieces of legislation that favored the abolitionist movement. You have the huge Supreme Court case of Dred Scott, which said basically that Black people have no rights, which white people are bound to respect, that they're effectively not citizens of this country. You have a failed raid, but John Brown's raid, his attempt to try and free the slaves in 1859. And then you have like the first shots of, Fort Sumter and the beginning of the Civil War. And it's this really crazy moment. But if you fast forward 3 years, it's the Emancipation Proclamation. Mm-hmm. It's the freeing of 4 million enslaved people. And it's, the beginnings of what will become this radical Reconstruction moment. And so I imagine that if you're living through, if you're in your prime in the 1850s and within a short, maybe 15, 20 year period, within one generation, you've seen rapid amounts of political change, social change, economic change. And that's kind of what this moment feels like to me. We never know what's going to happen in the next week or year or 5 years. But every day has been different and brought with it either hope or challenges. And that's what this moment feels like.
And, it's such a reminder. And so much of, I feel like, what we've done on this show is a reminder that how quickly the major story, the major narrative can change. We talk about elections and then the next midterm election feels like it's completely redefined anything. But on that front, Kelly and Nikki, you can jump in too. How do you think about elections specifically in that story? So much of the story you just told didn't really have to do with elections, yet we put all this psychic, at least, energy and political capital into capital E elections. So where do those, what's the balance of those into the mix of our political history?
I think in terms of political history, it's just sometimes an easy marker to grab onto, to leap off from, to talk about all sorts of different kinds of political changes. To be clear, elections have consequences. As Kelly was just saying, the person who won the 1860 election radically transformed U.S. history. So I don't want to undersell that. But I think that our minds go to elections because they are these kind of four-year markers that allow us easy access into thinking about the way that the country is changing or the way that the country is not changing.
Nikki, you want to jump in with where your mind's going?
Look, it wouldn't be an episode of This Day if somebody didn't bring up 1968.
Ah, yes.
So the reason that I've been thinking about 1968, that was actually a much closer election. Richard Nixon wins the popular vote by like under 1%. But it was also one of those times when politics was changing very quickly. Remember, Lyndon Johnson had won in 1964 in this massive landslide. He'd passed all of this key legislation, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. And by March of 1968, he's not running for re-election because he's become so unpopular due to the handling of the Vietnam War. And the other reason that I'm thinking about that particular election is there was a big shift happening in the U.S. Things were moving at a tectonic plate level. And this election is one of those places where we see those plates start to realign, yet we don't know quite what it's going to look like because it's such a close election, right? We have no idea what direction the country is going to go. And then 4 years later, Richard Nixon wins in one of the largest landslides in U.S. history. And 2 years after that, he's out on his ass because of Watergate. So it's just like, it's this period of crazy social and political change. And that election gives us a way into thinking about what's happening in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah. And I will, you know, chime in before we get to some of the listener emails. You know, I've been thinking about the 2004 election, actually. To me, that was, it's a sort of an under-discussed election, but to me, that was one in which I sensed a real divide in this country that I think has just grown and grown and grown in the years since. And I think every election since then has kind of, that's been my main takeaway, is just as I see results come in and I see the way the election played out, it's just this pit in my stomach of, my God, we are so divided. And sometimes it's around red states and blue states, and sometimes it's around, more and more, it's around rural and urban. But, you know, more than anything, it's just this opening, this widening gulf. And I remember in 2004 was an election in which I felt like each side could not possibly fathom how the other side thought. And, you know, Kerry supporters couldn't possibly imagine how people would support Bush, and Bush supporters couldn't possibly imagine how people would support Kerry. And it just felt like, you know, we're not having an argument around the same thing. We're just in different worlds. And that was one where that sort of first hit home for me. And I think more and more each election has borne that out. And I think this election absolutely just continues to bear that out. I mean, there's other narratives and storylines, but, you know, it's just that divide is deeper and deeper.
If you think about Kerry and Bush at that time, I look back at that and I'm like, man, it was so much more civil.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the dynamics, even of that very contentious election, still felt mature, or still felt like certain things were still being said based on facts and based on like an understood truth. We still had like a floor or a foundation from which people could pivot from. And it feels like with each election following 2004, 2008, certainly 2016 for sure, we have gotten even more, these divides have become even more acute and in the way that they have played out on the ground and really broken like all forms of trust in terms of like one another as Americans, but also the political system and how it works.
Yeah, I think that 2004 is another one of those kind of tectonic plate elections in the sense that you can begin to see the things that are going to define American presidential elections going forward. Remember, that's the year of Swift Boat Vets for Truth, people at the Republican convention wearing purple band-aids on their fingers to mock John Kerry's war service, but also where base politics was really used as a driver of the general election. So those anti-marriage equality ballot initiatives driving out voters who might not have been that hooked into Bush versus Kerry, but were driven to the polls because of other concerns.
Right. And that, I think, is kind of, you know, this is my big theory of modern American politics, but it's just that so much political identity and your identity have just become one at this point. And 2004 is the election in which I first started to really sense that. Yeah. And then again, like, you know, just even in the sort of liberal bubbles that I observed, just this inability to fathom how people could vote for Bush again, right? Mm-hmm. I just saw that in people and in liberals. And, you know, I think obviously a lot of people voted for Bush. And I think that there was just a gulf of understanding there, in addition to all those sort of tactical things that we've been discussing. So let's start to get into some of listener emails here. It is not surprising that we got a lot of emails from folks saying that they are thinking of the 2000 election here. And I will say that a lot of those emails came in on like Wednesday and even Thursday. And now maybe people are thinking less of the 2000 election now that it looks like this is a pretty decent win for Joe Biden at this point. But nevertheless, people are thinking of the 2000 election. Nikki, do you have any thoughts on kind of what from 2000 scans for now and what's different?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that the idea that the election might be decided in the courts is the big driver here. And here's where I want to sort of intervene in everyone's analogies, which is the reason you're thinking of the 2000 election is because you were meant to think of the 2000 election. This is a manufactured crisis of courts and seemingly close counts that aren't actually close counts and calls for recounts. All of these things were things that the Trump administration and Republicans had been planning for months because they understood they wouldn't win the popular vote. And if they were going to win the Electoral College, it was going to be very, very close, and they'd rather settle it in the courtroom. Now, Facts on the ground were so different that that hasn't hung together. But the reason that I think we're thinking about this, even things like what was named the Brooks Brothers riots, right? Like people trying to get into the counting centers, that's been planned 4 months to make you think of the Brooks Brothers riot, which involved Roger Stone, who is also a player in this administration. So the reason that I bring that up is I totally understand why everyone's thinking of 2000. And I just wanted to underscore that you are meant to think of 2000 because of political strategies.
I still think that there are aspects, though, that don't necessarily equate. So we're in a pandemic. And, you know, there was no coronavirus during 2000. And I think that the way that people have had to vote because of the pandemic, because of the use of mail-in ballots and absentee ballots. I remember when, you know, absentee ballots, the 2000 election was the first time I was like, oh, okay, we can do this. You know, like, I think that's the first time the public was like, there's another alternative of how you can vote. But I think this election is going to change a lot going forward in terms of how people choose to either mail in their ballot or choose an absentee ballot or vote in person, and what the trust in those systems will look like going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think 2000 was one in which the sort of like the bones of our democracy were sort of shown in the process, and how creaky and scattered and weird those are. And, you know, obviously Florida drives everyone batty every single election. I think people just go there, which is, you know, that's the paradox of Florida. It is like, it actually has its act together in terms of counting votes, and that's why it's always first to come out. But then for a lot of liberals, it consistently, you know, if Pennsylvania had Florida's way of counting and efficiency in counting, this election would have been called on Tuesday night, and everyone, you know, everyone's blood pressure would have dropped a little bit, certainly if you were rooting for Joe Biden. I reached out to Leon Nafok, who is the host of the wonderful podcast, historical podcast Fiasco. He also did Slow Burn, and he's been on this show before, but he did a whole series on 2000 and the Bush versus Gore, and I asked him kind of his thoughts on these parallels, and I just want to read a little of what he sent us. But yeah, I mean, it's along the lines of what you said, Nikki. He said, I'm quoting here, you know, that election got everyone used to the idea that courts can be used to secure victory and that a state's vote total can change decisively as a result of seemingly minor developments at the local level. The difference is that the Trump team is trying to start, quote, overtime early by pretending ballots were supposed to all be counted the night of the election and casting doubt on the ones that were counted after. And it's a reminder that Florida was really, you know, as broken as that may have ended up being, it was about a very marginal amount of ballots after the initial counting. And so, to your point, Nikki, I think people who want to cast doubt on this election want you to think of Florida. But Florida was a lesson in kind of very small incremental changes in a very localized place. And that's the difference here, right? There are five different states. You can't fight a Florida-like battle on five different fronts around much bigger margins. This strategy, this playbook, only works in one place around like 1,000 votes, and then maybe you can pull it off. That said, I will say, and you know, I think this gets maybe to some of the darker undertones of this election, but you know, I think it's evident that playbook was there. I think that the playbook of casting doubt and misinformation and then legal battles in place and the Supreme Court ready to back it up, that playbook actually was there. And I think they're trying to run those plays, but it's like running, you know, in football, like running a trick play when you're down four touchdowns. Like, it's cool, right? But it's not going to actually make a difference. But you run that, you run the Philly special to talk about my Eagles. You know, you run that when the game's on the line and it works. And so I think that's the big difference. I don't think that makes me feel great about democracy.
I'm grateful, though, that this is not an election where Florida was necessarily going to determine the whole ballgame. And I think that when we think about all of the swing states, you know, Georgia turning blue, possibly, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Arizona, even Texas for a while, there was talk, you know, about like its potential. And in the next, you know, maybe election or two, that's a possibility. But I think it just goes to show us that, like, we can't put all of our eggs in one basket, the Florida basket, or the Ohio basket, for that matter, either.
Yeah. I do want to mention one other thing from a previous episode that I've been thinking about, and then we'll get to some other listener emails. But Nikki, when we did the episode with Jad Abumrad of Radiolab, he had this great line about how when we vote, maybe we should go directly from the voting booth into an anechoic chamber, which is basically a soundproof isolation chamber. Go into there for 3 days and then emerge. And, you know, that would have worked. The anechoic chamber theory of American electoral politics would have worked this year. Just let the votes get counted and then we walk out into the sun and see what happens. But, of course, that is not the way our system works. Let's go to a couple other emails. We got an email from Christina, who did mention 1968, but in a slightly different way that you brought it up, Nikki, and just, you know, violence. And I think every time we talk about 1968 and is this 1968, is this not, what are the parallels? I think one big question that comes up is that this time has been in many ways less violent than the late 60s. There has been violence in this moment, but there have not, for instance, been political assassinations. Kelly, you know, what is your thought about how much violence marks a political era?
A lot of times I've looked at violence through wars and through the returning of veterans. So if you think about the end of the Civil War, and, you know, Confederates are coming home and they start the Ku Klux Klan in 1865. And then the Ku Klux Klan sort of wanes. And then if you think about World War One, and then soldiers are coming home from war, slightly disillusioned. And, you know, you see a resurgence in the KKK and Klan violence in the 19-teens. And in the 1920s, they've got like 6 million members. If you think about World War II and soldiers coming back from war, you have this uptick again of like white supremacist violence when it comes to like school desegregation and the civil rights movement. And I think you get a little bit more of that in the 60s as well. I think this is different because there's not like necessarily a war that you could point to where you have veterans who are coming back who are either disillusioned or using that to sort of speak to the moment. But when we look at these images of, you know, pro-Trump rallies, it looks like a lot of veterans. Mm-hmm. It looks like you have these militia-like groups and people with their, you know, like patriotic garb on. And so to me, you know, this is not just some fringe group of radical like Klansmen that are trying to incite violence. I think this is reflective of a lot of ways in which a good portion of the country feels. And so how to reconcile that violence for me, or this like sort of white supremacist, you know, oriented violence, it's really, really hard to reckon with. And I don't think that even with the Biden victory, we're going to see the end of either the temperature of white supremacist, you know, ideology decreasing, or even these sort of like, you know, protest skirmishes that feel very violent. I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's going to get worse.
Nikki?
Yeah, and then there's the question of this, the way that the protests in the summer were sort of retranslated into like a kind of political violence, even though they were, you know, overwhelmingly peaceful protests. And that's, you mentioned 68. And so I was thinking about that again, like the ways that when there are police riots, it opens the door for these kinds of law and order messages that Donald Trump tried this year as well. It has proven not to be ultimately successful for him. But I think that that is something that has shaped the 2020 election, is the way that that sort of retranslation of protest into violence has been front and center for for everyone. And I think, you know, the white power violence that Kelly is talking about, something that we've seen throughout the Trump years, had led to real concerns about specifically election-related violence. And we've been quite fortunate not to have seen that in this year's election. And I think that that's one comforting note, although we'll see what happens in the future.
I mean, I think it's an interesting question of what the story of this election is. If, you know, I think that there will be a big part of this country that thinks of this as an illegitimate election, including Donald Trump. And so, and does that stoke sustained fears and sustained violence for the next few years? We'll see. You know, again, I just think when it's actually really close, that narrative is sticky, and this may not end up being that close.
We'll always have conspiracy theories.
Oh, yeah. So a couple other emails. We got an email from Ian who sort of was thinking about Reagan. So, you know, Biden is about to become the oldest president ever, surpassing Ronald Reagan. And, you know, Ian brought up that, the question of age, and I'm curious how you think about that. But also then, shortly into Reagan's term, when there was an assassination attempt on Reagan. And so I think there's a little bit of, as we've been saying, upheaval does not just end after an election. So I don't know where your head goes with this, Nikki, but any reactions to these Reagan parallels?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Reagan parallels are helpful in the sense that they show us the way that this process has been cleared up. Right. So if a president is incapacitated, we now have a pretty clear roadmap for how power is transferred, a lot of which obviously came out with the 25th Amendment, but was worked out in moments like 1981 when Reagan is shot, when people aren't quite sure who power goes to, and some people don't want to give power to George H.W. Bush. And so, like, those fights happen in 1981. And so we have just a much clearer roadmap about incapacitation. As for, like, the oldest president ever. I mean, that's absolutely the case. And part of it is just that people live a lot longer now. But I do think that there is something, we talk about it with Reagan, we can talk about it with Biden, we can talk about it with Trump, about a kind of sense of American gerontocracy, which is to say that we have such a young, vibrant country in a lot of ways, but our political leaders, almost across the board, including in the Senate, are incredibly old. And what does that disconnect between generational experiences mean for our politics when you have a very vibrant movement of younger people who are really pushing the parties in one direction, and then a group of office holders who aren't as tapped into that?
Kelly, someone wrote in, Cole wrote in and said, I've been thinking a lot about Ford pardoning Nixon, mainly the line in Ford's speech that, quote, our national nightmare is over, our Constitution works. For some reason, I don't think a Trump pardon would exactly go over the same way. But do you have any thoughts, Kelly?
Oh, man, you know, I'm good at looking at the past. I'm not great at looking at the future or predicting the future. And I think, you know, I think maybe even 5 years ago, I could have said, oh, of course, these things will happen. Trump has done so many things politically that are unprecedented. I cannot speculate very well on, like, what would an aftermath look like. I will say, though, that the past, 9 times out of 10, does serve a useful roadmap, but I don't know, not with this presidency.
Yeah. So let me frame it then a little bigger, you know, which is this larger question. I think you used the word reckoning. But, you know, how does this country reckon? How does this country move on? Are we generally pretty good at it? Are we generally pretty not good at it? You know, and what lessons from the past are there in terms of moving forward from a tumultuous era?
I think it really depends on who is in leadership. And I do believe, you know, I'm an optimist. So I believe that Biden will do a lot of things to cool the temperatures of the water right now. I think that when he gave, you know, sort of his post-election speech about trying to say, listen, I will be the president of all America. Like, I'm not just, this is not just, you know, spiking the ball for the Democratic Party. I'm hopeful of that. I do think that Biden is much more of a moderate or centrist in terms of, like, his politics than probably more Democrats would want him to be. But I think that he can sort of turn down the dial a little bit. That is my hope. I think that Trump is not going away. And so this idea of presidents that sort of lose elections and then go off into the good dark night and you don't really see them again until like funerals or like major, you know, issues. I think we're going to be seeing Trump every single day. We're certainly going to still keep hearing from him on Twitter. And I do think that that's going to shape part of the narrative going forward for half of the country that still is, you know, going to be disappointed.
I will also add to that. I mean, I think the country is very good at moving on. It's not very good at reckoning. I would also just say about the pardon. Remember, that pardon was deeply unpopular. Americans were so mad about that pardon. And so Ford does this and thinks it's going to be this gesture of sort of like bringing the country together. And the country is not brought together by that moment. And in fact, Ford loses his election 2 years later. And Nixon, though, I will say, does go silently into that good night. Like, he writes a lot of books, but he is not a super visible person on the scene by the mid-1970s.
Yeah.
So another date that came up quite a lot was 1876. Josh wrote in to say that he had been thinking a lot about that Hayes-Tilden election, but not just the election, how it played out, what the consequences of that election is. I mean, Kelly, why do you think the 1876 election is on so many people's minds right now?
I mean, if we think about 1876, it's the official end of Reconstruction, or what a lot of historians look at as the end of Reconstruction. It's also known as like the Great Compromise, where, you know, sort of Northern Republicans, you'll get your president, but basically all of the concessions that we want troops out of the South. You know, we want cabinet positions. We want to industrialize the South. We still want to have position and leverage. And the ability to be able to determine where the South goes from here. And so, you know, I do think it's election that a lot of historians look back on as this real pivotal moment, particularly not too long after the Civil War, when we're still grappling with like slavery and we're still grappling with what a newly freed Black population will look like and what's in store for them. This is shortly also after the Civil Rights Act of 1875, I believe, that basically wasn't able to really take effect again until 100 years later. So you really start to see what Du Bois says in this great quote where he says, "The slave stood free, stood for a moment in the sun, and then like went back into the darkness." And it's this really dismal moment going forward in terms of race relations that are really troubling to me. So I don't know what this will look like going forward. I hope that it's not a bunch of like symbolic gestures and then no real substantive change, particularly in terms of race relations. But we'll have to see how it plays out. But no question, 1876 is pivotal.
And the reason that compromise was happening, we should add for listeners who don't remember, is the election was mostly like tied or disputed in several states. And so neither man had the votes that he needed in order to claim the presidency. And so there was this kind of negotiation over, you take the presidency, we'll take the South. That sense that political bargaining at a higher level will sell out the coalition that brought you into power, I think there are certainly people out there right now who are like, ah, I don't want that to happen. I'm worried about that.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a very interesting moment for political compromise and bargaining in the way that you describe. Let's see. We'll do a couple more and then we'll start to wrap up and we can go back to checking Pennsylvania results. there was a tweet floating around from Patrick Ruffini, who's a Republican pollster, and he was thinking about 1992. He said a Republican president loses re-election by maybe a closer margin than expected, while Republicans gain 10 seats in the House, a precursor to their massive 1994 wins. So I'm not going to fact check every single one of those, but I do think this general point of you can look to 1992 and then what happened in 1994 as very interesting. And we've talked about the 1994 election, the Newt Gingrich contract with America, the way that galvanized the Republican Party. And again, a reminder that, you know, if you ever look at a political party and say there's disarray here, that can change really quickly. And it is often that vacuum of disarray that allows someone to come in and whip things together. I think that is one of the big questions facing, I guess, both parties right now, but I think definitely facing the Republican Party right now is, you know, will Trumpism persist and be enough to sustain, you know, into the next midterm and so forth? Or is there a vacuum there that someone else is going to kind of try and come in and redefine the Republican Party. Nikki, do you have thoughts here?
Yeah, I just wanted to come in to say that there are some competing historical analogies we can play with here, including like 2000. Very close election. And in 2002, what happens? Instead of losing seats in the Congress, Bush and the Republicans actually gain seats in the Congress. Yeah. Or look at 2008, which was pretty close to a blue wave in 2008. And in 2010, you get that same kind of 1994 backlash of Republicans just sweeping in huge numbers. So I'm not entirely convinced that we can look at the presidential election and know what will happen in 2 years. But I do think it's important to kind of keep in mind, as I'm sure many, many Americans are thinking right now, about 2022 as we finally get a call on 2020.
Yeah, just how quickly things, you know, again, can change in just a year or two. All right, let's start to wrap up here. And we got a number of notes that brought up Lincoln and different parts of Lincoln's presidency. But, you know, David wrote in and said, I find myself thinking of two historical events. One, Lincoln's unpopular entry to Washington as he was elected and how divided the country was. And then the second Lincoln inaugural, which is the famous Better Angels of Our Nature speech, often thought of as one that really helped unite the country and offer a vision of hope. I think even, you know, when people saw Joe Biden, the first remarks he offered when the election was still a little bit in flux and there was a, you know, things were looking like they were fraying, a lot of people saw echoes of that Lincoln speech. So, Kelly, how much is Lincoln on the mind these days?
Yeah, I think Lincoln is always there, especially when it comes to divisions and especially when it comes to racial divisions. I think that, you know, Lincoln's goal was always to keep the country together, always to keep the Union together. So when you look at his first inaugural address and he's like trying to keep the country together, he's like, sure, we'll keep the fugitive slave law. Sure, keep your slaves. Like, let's just be happy, guys. Like, and he's trying desperately to woo and win the South back into the Union. But by the time, you know, you get to the second inaugural and the really, you know, slavery is all but dead. Now the healing really has to start. And so Lincoln is hugely responsible for how we can imagine a world going forward and how the healing process might start and how we might try to think of the United States as a collective, cohesive country again. And that's, you know, an intense amount of work, given the fact that, you know, the Confederacy was its own country, so to say, for several years. So thinking about how to do that work, I think is what Biden's going to have to do now. Is we are desperately split in the way that we see one another. And so he's going to have to be positive. He's going to have to be inclusive. He's going to have to do a lot of work. And let's just be honest, we're not going to save everybody. You know, like some people don't want to ever, you know, change their points of view about how they see the country going forward.
Let me ask you about that, actually, because I think that that's such a big part of what people think about. It's like, you know, it's one thing for a Biden to give a speech like that about how we're all healing and we should all be united, you know, but it's another thing for the people who he's trying to convey that message to actually hear him. And I think that's where a lot of people's skepticism comes in. And I wonder, did Lincoln face that problem? Like, we have this sort of vision in our head that Lincoln gave the speech and everyone heard it and everyone felt it. But was there that contingent that was just saying, no, this is not for me. Like, you know, you can have your healing and shove it.
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. I think that, you know, even when you think about all through Reconstruction, even really until this day, like we have not, and we use this word a lot, reckoned, but we have not reckoned with slavery. We have not reckoned with these divisions. We've not reckoned with let's just say white supremacy. Let's just put it out there like that. And I think we saw this a lot in this election, an inability for white people in particular to relinquish their power, their privilege, you know, what the benefits of whiteness. And I think you see that in almost every election. You think, look at all of these horrible things that are happening. Surely that's more valuable than whiteness. And it's not. And I think that's what is so demoralizing to people of color, is that, is there anything that will pull at the heartstrings of whiteness in order to get people to think about the collective good of the nation? And I'm not so sure that there is. That sounds dismal. Like I said, I'm an optimist, but I think we've all underestimated the power of white supremacy when it comes to someone's vote.
Obviously, like, not everyone heard Lincoln's speech the way that he intended it after what happened in 1865. And, you know, we've had presidents, and I think Joe Biden will be the kind of president who is able to speak in that empathetic register. But again, like, you can reach out. That right. doesn't mean that somebody is going to take your hand. Yeah. And I think, Kelly, that's very much to your point.
Okay, we're going to wrap it up here. I do want to read one more email, and we don't have to remark on it if we want. I just think it stands on its own, but I just want to read a note that we got from Merck. Merck writes us that she is also thinking about 1968, but in Vietnam. Specifically, she writes us about the Battle of Hue, which was part of the Tet Offensive during the Vietnam War. And she writes, "My mom was four during that time, and I grew up hearing her stories of bombs going off in her hometown and her family running into nearby churches for refuge. I can't imagine experiencing that at any age, but the fact that she lived and survived to tell the tale makes me so happy that she and my dad were able to escape their war-torn country and have the freedom to do things like vote in this country. No matter how this election turns out, and even though it's as if we're facing another war of sorts here, my family and I have rights that my parents worked so hard for, and I am proud of that." So that's a lovely note from Merck. Gets me a little teary-eyed. But yeah, we will end it there. That is a wonderful way to end the show. And I will say, Kelly Jackson, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me, as always.
And Nicole Hammer, thanks to you, as always.
Thank you, Jody.
And we can go back to checking the latest results from Pennsylvania. And we will go back to a regular scheduled show on Sunday, where we will be looking at one moment from political history. But this felt like a really good way to sort of sum up a lot of our history, because this is one of those moments where we're thinking about a lot of different things. So thanks to everyone who wrote in, and thanks to everyone who's listening. This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of the Radiotopia Network from PRX. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. We'll be back again with the show on Sunday. As I said, if you have any questions or comments in the meantime, you can email us thisdaypod@gmail.com. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Radiotopia.